I'm Carrie Thornton, Curator of Education, and I'm happy to welcome you to the last Tuesday evening of the fall 2011 season. And I will break here to say please turn off your cell phones, because it wouldn't be a Tuesday evening if I didn't say that. Even though tonight, of course, is the last one for the fall season, we will begin again on February 7th with Glenn Ligon and Scott Rothkopf in conjunction with Glenn Ligon America, which opens here at the museum that following weekend. So what you'll get for that lecture is actually a preview of the exhibition. I think they're going to kind of do a walkthrough of the exhibition together as curator and artist. So I encourage you to mark your calendars. If you're a member, you'll be receiving something in the mail, and if you're not, always know that the website, of course, is your source. So go there and check out when the Tuesday evenings start up and what the lineup is. It will be going up probably in December, if not early January. So I think that Glenn and Scott will be a really good way to start the next season, and I have to say that tonight there really could not be a better way to end what has been, I think, a really exceptional season this fall. I've enjoyed it very much, and I know some of you have faithfully attended, and I've had conversations, and I know some of you are in agreement. I offered Katie Siegel this date in hopes that she would be our finale, and lucky for all of us, she accepted. This was the date that worked for her. Katie is a professor of art history at Hunter College in New York, editor-in-chief of Art Journal, and a contributing editor to Art Forum with roots in Texas, having received her PhD from the University of Texas in 1995. In addition to teaching at Hunter, Katie has been a senior critic at the Yale University School of Art and was a visiting associate professor at Princeton University from 2007 to 2009. Katie Siegel is perhaps best known to many of us for her significant contribution to the contemporary art discourse with numerous articles and essays on modern and contemporary artists and issues, art issues for major publications and institutions, as well as having co-authored the go-to book on the relationship between contemporary art and commerce, that being Artworks, Money, published in 2004. And then, of course, there's the subject of tonight's lecture, what Dave Hickey has described as the discovery of the next great art historical subject, the book Since 45 America and the Making of Contemporary Art, which I hope you were able to purchase tonight or already owned and were able to have signed by Katie before the lecture. Plus, most recently, she has published Abstract Expressionism with Feiden, and then also Katie is, and I think many of you know this, recognized as a curator with exhibitions such as High Times, Hard Times, New York Painting 1967 to 75, which toured internationally and received a prize from the International Association of Art Critics. And then she is currently working on a large historical painting exhibition for the Wexner Center, which will open in 2013. So be on the lookout for that. My invitation to Katie was based on an interview I read in the Brooklyn Rail on the then very recently published Since 45. I was particularly taken with how the book was structured and, as Hickey said, the fact that Katie seemed to be breaking some very interesting new ground in how art is considered and written about in light of unavoidably influential historical events and cultural conditions. I was also impressed that she seemed to have no ego attached to this accomplishment, this discovery, proclaiming that, as she does in the preface of the book, that in making up for what she considered a deficiency in her knowledge of contemporary art issues in order to meet the needs of studio undergrads and graduate students in her first teaching position, she discovered that her thesis for her doctoral dissertation on aspects of American art between 1945 to 1968 had been misguided. Unfortunately, as impressed as I was with the fact that tonight's presentation was initially with that fact, tonight's presentation was initially misrepresented, and hopefully you did not see that printing. We tried to get it corrected quickly, but there were some problems. So what I did was by including a quote on the position of the dissertation, it seemed that it was in fact the position that the book Since 45 was written on, and it's not at all. And so I apologize for such a ridiculous mistake that, thanks to the popularity of the career of Katie Siegel, seems to have been picked up early by every possible online post. Hopefully you read the book and caught my mistake. I actually met somebody coming in this evening that had done that. But if, in fact, you think you're here under false pretenses, I want to reassure you that the discoveries of this book as presented tonight will have you reconsidering everything you thought you knew about art since 1945. And I think in the end, win you over, because as art historian Richard Schiff has said in praise of Katie and the book, Katie Siegel may be our most insightful critic of contemporary art. And he goes on to say, this most unusual book, a brilliant critical history, ends up revealing what's crucial right now. So please join me in welcoming Katie Siegel.
Oh, thanks, Terry, for that ridiculously nice introduction. And I'm sure no one read the press release at all, except for the one typical graduate student who caught the mistake. Tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the overall premise for the book, and then talk about one chapter in specific. But I'm happy to talk about any of it at the end. So I've spent much of the last 20 years, and we can have the first image. I spent much of the last 20 years banging my head against one problem in various states of cluelessness and consciousness with varying degrees of success. And you're nice to say, Terry, that it's egoless for me to acknowledge the faults of my education. But I think if, just like with artists, if you, art historians, if they are being thoughtful about what they're doing, we make all kinds of mistakes and realize we take all kinds of false paths. But so the thing that I've been trying to figure out is the bad fit between how contemporary art is accounted for in books and schools, the way that I learned it, no fault of UT, but the way that it's written about in textbooks and journal articles, the way it's placed into histories and museums, and then on the other hand, how I actually experience that art. So these two things, and I realized, weren't really fitting. And for a long time, and I know there are a lot of graduate students here, a long time I just thought I was maybe a little bit stupid, and maybe this is a feeling that other people, even artists, have had reading a difficult text or finding out that the way you understand art doesn't seem smart enough or doesn't seem right according to the way that it's written about in books. The academic apparatus for understanding contemporary art, which is unthinkingly inherited, the young people keep replicating it over and over, is so deeply ingrained in us that, like any ideology, like any myth, we almost can't see it. Although many people besides myself have identified some part of this academic way of seeing contemporary art. Roberta Smith, who's the primary critic for the New York, art critic for the New York Times, has pointed to over and over again what she calls curator's art, and art that is in museums, not because people like it and not because people enjoy it and maybe not because it's been so great, but curators want to be smart, and so they put it in museums. And I don't know if there are any curators here tonight. I hope I'm not offending them. This is a Ronnie Horn show that she used this phrase in reference to when it was up at the Whitney Museum. And she kind of said the same thing about the Sherry Levine show that's up at the Whitney, just opened at the Whitney last week. It's ostentatiously brainy and formally withholding. Her husband, Jerry Saltz, who's the main art critic for the New York Magazine, but also probably the biggest worldwide critic because of his Facebook page, his complaints about academic critics are only two examples. And this contrast between the academic critic And that's, I have to stay by the microphone, that's Rosalind Krauss in the lower right. And then she's sort of holding forth, looking like a perfect academic, and I hope I don't look that way when I talk. And then on the upper left, there's Jerry's Facebook page, and he's up there with Bill Clinton. And so this sort of contrast between two ways of seeing art, and it actually has, you know, I realize that this is an easy thing to see when you're reading art criticism. What was a revelation to me when I started really doing the research for this book is to realize how old this conflict is in American history, the conflict between the person who, like, Charles Eliot, like the head of Harvard, is coming, the inheritor of the Transcendental School of Philosophy, is here to uplift and ennoble the ordinary man. And then there's the self-made man, Jerry Saltz, where you do it yourself and you teach yourself everything you have to know. And this contrast in the U.S. is a long, long-running one. As opposed to, say, Europe, where all of the intellectuals are state-certified, university-bred intellectuals. Here in America, we have this counter-history of the independently formed intellectual, the autodidact. So I've come to believe that the dominant academic framework for thinking about contemporary art is just wrong. For example, in discussing American and contemporary European art, and still today art from all over the world, critics and historians have relied too much on an older European model of artistic activity framed in terms of a convention-shattering avant-garde, rejecting the market, shocking and repelling the public, with an insider group of intelligentsia leading clueless collectors to the important work of the moment. And this is the academic model from the late 19th century in Europe, and it's really the one we're still operating with today. This model, of course, is enormously flattering to writers and intellectuals who can see themselves as dashing rebels rather than just impoverished freelancers and bloggers, and or like professors, they're actually guardians of the children of the upper classes at Ivy League universities, sort of glorified babysitters, or even just ordinary people doing an ordinary job teaching about art history. Instead, it's very glamorous to think of yourself as a rebellious hero. Art historians also have tended to take for granted an autonomous history of a way of making art called modernism. It's modern art objects about modern art. So art is always about art, and you have to know about art to understand any art. Teaching contemporary art this way has conditioned both the view of art from the 1960s and also the subjects that contemporary artists were supposed to be interested in, resulting in several generations of quasi sort of minimalist work. Here's another museum shot of a young artist in the Whitney Biennial, which is supposedly coming from constructivism and other European avant-garde. So you walk into the floor of the Whitney, and there's just like a lot of square, monochrome, rectangular art. And then artists in their 20s talking about constructivism, and I know quite well from knowing many artists in their 20s that constructivism is not actually the thing that's uppermost on their mind, but it's a way of talking to curators so that they understand you and they will put you in the Whitney Biennial. Again, apologies to the curators in the audience. Of course, American post-war art had some things in common with older European modernism. It's not totally different. We belong to the same social system, which we call capitalism, and art plays generally the same role in the social system. Rich people buy it. The rest of us, you know, a small percentage of us look at it and think about it, and most people don't care at all about it. The wish of some artists to connect to a modernist tradition, some artists are really interested in earlier avant-gardes, and a history marked by discontinuity and rupture, by sudden change. But what art historians and critics almost never talked about were the American social conditions, the history of America or of earlier American as opposed to European art that might have shaped this new art, except in connection to work that overtly critique or was seen to critique or make fun of America. Even while critics tended to divorce contemporary American art from an American past, I saw many artists who didn't fit this official history from the recent past and present as very much involved with the post-war art I had studied originally in the 50s. So people like Amy Silman, who's a very significant and interesting contemporary painter, is very interested in abstract expressionism and its general ethos of immediate experience and unfinishedness. And this has been a topic, abstract expressionism, that's been sort of taboo in the American university for a long time, not in the studio side, but in the art history side. Or even younger artists like Matthew Day Jackson, who directly takes on the subject of the Cold War. And these are two paintings done in burnt wood that are aerial views of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's also a giant car engine in front of them because he really loves muscle cars and likes to rebuild them. So these artists like Amy and Matthew Day Jackson so often saw more than the critics did. I believe that it's only possible now for critics and historians to see clearly what the significant changes of that post-war moment were and what its significant subjects were, ranging from the climax of the American century to the real meaning and extent of the often proclaimed death of the avant-garde, the premium we place on youth, the rise and fall of talk about art and art discourse, and the figure of the critic historian, and the increasing importance of the mass audience, the way that museums and artists are increasingly focused on a mass audience and not an art audience that's just interested in art for art's sake. Since 45, my book is an attempt to do some of this. Instead of a historical narrative of the familiar modernist sort, where you have constructivism and cubism and so on, one after the other, it addresses a series of subjects set up as extreme oppositions that I see as central to American contemporary art and life, such as black and white, which for all of its implications of race and a range of other subjects is central to American art in a way that it's not in Europe, and also the one and the many, the subject of the mass audience and the self-made individual as being different in America from the version of those the one and the many in Europe. Overall, the book suggests a different way to think the history of contemporary art over the past 50 years since the ascension of the United States to world power. And on the one hand, what happened in 1945, the dropping of the atomic bomb and the American victory in World War II, was a sort of irrevocable wiping of the historical slate. On the other hand, it's also true, as I just said, that post-war art retained ties to earlier modernism. In addition, understanding art after 1945 requires attention to the earlier history of American art and the social conditions in which it existed, so as to see how this history interfered with the modernism that was created under European social conditions. The very continuity or connection to American history created a break in art history, which has, from the 19th century, really been just about Europe, which tells a primarily European story. So it's a kind of bringing in the history of America creates a break in the history of art history. It's very complicated, and to make matters even more complicated, the kind of historical break that 1945 was understood to mark, merging the first man of a new age with the last man of Armageddon, is an apocalyptic one. Not just a rupture, like with the avant-garde, the next new shocking thing, but it's sort of the rupture, an absolute endpoint to history, with startling precedents in American literature and historical imagination, a crisis-driven all-or-nothing tradition that dates back to the rhetoric of the Puritans. Tonight I want to talk about Last and First Men, and that's the last chapter in my book. In 1950, historian Perry Miller made a survey of apocalyptic literature in the wake of its post-war American revival called The End of the World. Miller found the fulfillment of the vision of Puritan Jonathan Edwards in the United States Bombings Survey, an unlikely source, which is a government document about the use of atomic and other bombs in World War II. This text, the latest and first historical entry in the apocalyptic canon, described the predicted elements of intense light and heat and the uselessness of human institutions in the face of this conflagration. For a dry scientific text, it surprisingly echoed the original apocalyptic text, the Bible. So I'm saying that this history, this new epoch in history, which everyone agreed was marked in 1945, and this book, which was rushed out in just a few weeks after the dropping of the atomic bomb, so that everyone agrees that this is a new epoch, but it's one that it's an understanding of beginning, sudden beginning and end, an apocalyptic history, which is so different from European history, that was in much older and had much older roots in American ways of thinking, where we have so much evangelical thinking, which is really foreign to other countries. While European intellectuals and scholars focused on the impact of the concentration camps and the devastation of German cities after World War II, in the U.S., journalistic reports focused on the invention of the bomb and its effect on Hiroshima, that first shocking event overwhelming the imagination. And then the imagined future use of the bomb would dominate imaginations for decades to come. This is a newspaper from Milwaukee, and it's an imagination of if someone dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Milwaukee, done right after 1945 and dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima. And so lots of cities all over the U.S., lots of people were imagining what would happen if the bomb was dropped on their city, because once the United States had it, it was all too easy to imagine other countries having it. And I think it's the event that was the single thing that was most broadly known by a general public. 98% of Americans knew about the atomic bombs used in Hiroshima, and today I don't think 98% of Americans know about anything in any single event. I'm sure we're all thinking of lots of different important things, but not just one thing. For ambitious artists in New York, 1945 meant all of these things, but it also meant certain special things. A decisive break with Europe, whose failures and depredations were revealed fully in the aftermath of the war, and a consequent rethinking of America's difference from Europe in a manner more penetrating and interesting than the chauvinistic sort of nationalist fictions of Thomas Hart Benton and other American scene artists. So there had been lots of people promoting America and Americanness in the 1930s, but Americanness in the 30s meant provincial, it meant white, it meant rural, and then America in 1945 suddenly means the people who won the war, also the people who dropped the atomic bomb, but it means a lot more complicated things. In 1947, Isamu Noguchi devised a proposal for a monumental public sculpture, a huge human head drawn in the land that was meant to be seen from outer space, inspired by the Indian mounds of Ohio. Originally called Memorial to Man, the work was inspired by the use of the atomic bomb in 1945 and the threat it represented, the end of the human race, at least on Earth. Noguchi traveled around the world after World War II, visiting Stonehenge and other ancient large-scale works, and he saw himself as an Earth artist. His final title for the work, which was never built, was Sculpture to be Seen from Mars. Noguchi was in sync with post-war science fiction that ventured space travel not only as an exciting exploration, an extension of the American frontier, but as a horrible inevitability as small bands of humans fled a doomed planet. So people really believed, including Noguchi, that there was a chance that the world would be destroyed, and that's why we needed space travel. When Noguchi went to visit Hiroshima in 1950, and he was originally Japanese, hoping to participate in the design of the Peace Park there, he found a still devastated city. Taking part in a discussion about plans for Hiroshima, the artist proclaimed it the most modern city in the world, as the leveling and erasure of the old provided the opportunity to create an entirely new, forward-looking city. Noguchi was certainly not alone in connecting imagery drawn from the distant past with a sense that a far-off future might be coming quickly and might return us in some way to the beginning of time. In the reaction to the horrors of World War II, the late 1940s and artists of the 40s ushered in matched opposites of futurism and primitivism, in that the force that was dropped on Hiroshima was scientific and man-made rather than natural, and that the new beginning threatened the absolute end, as well as a kind of awe or terror before that finality. The first man, which was a popular anthropological term, was very possibly the last. And many of the artists of the 1940s, including Jackson Pollock, Adolf Gottlieb, Barnett Newman, who you see here with a painting called Genesis, The Break, from 1946, and Norman Lewis, who's perhaps the least known of the abstract expressionists, who was African-American and often painted in black and white. These artists, and he has a kind of rupture of the cosmos here, of the sky being ripped apart. He was especially interested in Einstein and in physics. So many of these artists studied, collected, and emulated the emotional qualities of what they saw as the art of primitive cultures. Newman curated exhibitions of pre-Columbian and Northwest Coast objects and wrote, at the most general abstract level, that the first man was an artist, making a broad analogy between the contemporary artist and an imaginary caveman in a 1947 essay of that title. Philip Guston, too, said, "I imagine wanting to paint as a caveman would when nothing has existed before." And Jackson Pollock, and this is a detail of a Pollock drip painting, and Adolf Gottlieb, both put their handprints directly into their paintings, evoking the directness and imagery of cave paintings like those in Lascaux, and Pollock, like a lot of them, owned a book about Lascaux. These artists all felt a connection to the primitive man who had no history and whom they imagined accessing powerful feelings and expressions without the dulling veneer of the sophistication and even decadence of civilization. Scholars have recently emphasized the primitivism of these artists in the sense that they romanticized and imitated their fantasy version of primitive peoples, conflating the archaic, the things, cavemen from ancient times, and the indigenous people from the Pacific Rim, Indians, Africans. But it's interesting to note that we'll get there in a minute. It's interesting to note that they, like Noguchi, associated these old, even ancient forms with the radically new. So they're making things that look like Lascaux, but they are thinking that these are new images to be making in 1945. Many of the artists of the time expressed the wish to paint as if painting had never existed before, to start from zero. This had a particularly American aspect. Primitivism as an ideology in the U.S. post-World War II is predicated on the coming disaster as a result of human advances or technology. In part, this may be because the U.S. itself was the product of just such unimaginable violence. It had already happened in the erasure of the Indian population in the U.S., and so it was not imaginable but an actual historical fact. The wish to be the first man was often equally matched by the sense of being among the last, the myth of regeneration through violence, the decimation of an entire land and people to create, in Daniel Boone's words, the new Eden. So the settlers imagined themselves coming to an empty land, but it was only empty, of course, because they had killed all the Indians. We can take Henry David Thoreau as a prime model of this first man, a type that has maintained a central position in American culture since the 19th century. His passion for natural study was a kind of sublimation of the hunting passion of Americans, and he imagined of Indians. At Walden, just outside Boston, walking distance from his mother's house, he recreated the experience of the Puritan pioneer living on the frontier of civilization, the verge of absolute nature. Walden is the story of a man bound and captive by society, struggling against the death and deadness of his civilization. Thoreau's break with American civilization was given new forms after World War II, with the atomic bomb casting an uncertain light on modern urban culture. Certain artists, like Barnett Newman, who admired Thoreau very much, and poets like Charles Olson, but also the mass media, seemed to echo the Thoreauian model. And here we have Fred McMurray and Colette Colbert in a still from The Agony. Perhaps the most popular symbol of this interest was Betty McDonald's 1947 book, The Agony, a memoir recounting her move to a small farm in rural Washington after her marriage, as her husband's dream was to leave his office job to start a chicken ranch. And then this was made into an enormously successful movie starring Fred McMurray and Claudette Colbert. And it's sort of a humorous story about the city dwellers moving to the country and how they don't really know what to do with the chickens and everything like that. But it's also meshes with the many people who, after the use of the atomic bomb, began to build bomb shelters, not only in cities, but rural retreats, because they thought the cities would be the target of the atomic bomb. And shortly afterwards, the Agony was followed by a still more radical version of this retreat, the Helen and Scott Nearing book, Living the Good Life, chronicling their move to an older house in rural Vermont and their simple, self-sufficient lifestyle. The Nearings, these are sort of all American figures, but the Nearings were communists, and like Barnett Newman, combined an interest in international socialism with the peculiarly American vein of the independent community, peopled by independent individuals, free of government control. So they're both sort of communists and they're kind of libertarians, the way you have people living off the grid in Idaho. While and it all comes from Thoreau, both these very right-wing and left-wing ideas. While these old American ideas resurfaced right after World War II, they exploded in the 1960s and 70s. The Nearings books was republished in both 1970 and 1972 and was both an inspiration for and a symptom of the Back to the Land movement, which became so large that it registered statistically in the census in the early 1970s. So many people had left the cities to go back to the land that the rural areas were being repopulated. And part of the reason I was particularly interested in this, and I won't digress too much, was that resonates enormously with young people today. And I don't know if it's as true in Texas, where your cities are not quite as miserable as the East Coast. But I have a lot of students who are leaving New York to go live in the country, to go live in very rural areas, and a lot of art students who are quitting art to become farmers. And there's a real movement. Everybody in Brooklyn where I live has beards. They all make their own beer. My neighbor two doors down in Brooklyn has chickens. So this Back to the Land is having a real resurgence. So fantasies about prehistory and going back to earlier moments were widespread throughout the art and culture of the 1960s and 70s, almost always based on reconnecting to nature. And this was certainly true in terms of feminist art. And this is Carolee Schneeman, who's painted her face, she imagines, as a sort of primordial goddess and enacting a ritual. And it's very common to see this kind of goddess imagery in feminist work of the 60s and 70s. And despite the ostensibly progressive orientation of the politics, much of the hippie imagery and self-fashioning was basically primitivist. This is Alan Shields at an art opening with some art patrons who are dressed quite differently than he is. You can pick out the artist in this picture. And he made his own clothing, part of a do-it-yourself. But hand-dyed, hand-sewn clothing, long hair, beards, love beads, worn by both men and women, invoked paganism and a range of third-world cultures, general concepts of indigenous pre-modernism, and still more generally, so basically Indian and Pacific Rim cultures, but also more generally an attitude against professional work and uniform culture. In particular, many of the trappings, moccasins, beads, face paint, tents, invoked a general concept of the American Indian. Founding communes in the country, living in the canyons where you could trap your own food, these all drew on the imagination of a pre-modern way of life. These ideas and values also found their way into the mainstream through an interest in naturalness, whole foods, natural clothing, natural makeup or no makeup, natural hair, recycling organic foods. And again, like the Back to the Land movement, you can see that these are all having a resurgence today. Even psychedelic drugs can be traced back to Native Americans' use of peyote and magic mushrooms. This longing backward look to nature of the 1960s was matched by making new plans for the future in the form of utopian communities and new kinds of architecture that they hoped would facilitate new social forms. The most prominent figure here was Buckminster Fuller. Alan Shields, the artist that you see, drew heavily on his own an inspiration from his own family background in Kansas, where female relatives quilted and sewed to make his unusually shaped, sewn, dyed, and even beaded structures. But he was also interested in making his art inspired by Buckminster Fuller. And this is a painting that's shaped like a pyramid from 1967 called Whirling Dervish. And the canvas, it's made out of canvas, so he calls it a painting, but it's dyed rather than painted with a brush. So it's dyed the way a quilt or fabric would be. And it's shaped like a pyramid to sit in the middle of the room because Buckminster Fuller imagined we would all be living in these dome-shaped houses, no more square, rectangular buildings. And so Alan Shields believed him, and he thought, well, we need paintings that can hang on walls that aren't flat. So we won't really have walls. We'll have to make paintings that will go in the middle of the room. So it's a hippie painting, the way it looks, but it also has this belief. It's primitive looking, but it also implies this belief in the future. And the painting is also on wheels, so when you install this painting, you can just kind of push it around, which is very nice. for curators, but it's also because he imagines himself as a nomad, like with his yurt, traveling around the country, rolling up his tent, and also rolling up his painting. There's a lot of pyramid imagery in the 60s. This is an early sculpture by Paul Tech, who also takes the pyramid shape but takes a more critical or dystopic look at the contrast between the rough and the handmade and the futuristic. The then dominant sculptural model of minimalism, like Donald Judd and Richard Serra, which he believed was basically futuristic and technological, and he contrasts it with his own interest in warm materiality, with his hairy, waxy flesh sculptures sealed inside these plexiglass boxes that Tech began showing in 1964. So what's inside looks like meat, looks like a person, it looks organic, and what's outside looks cold and sort of harsh. Tech was one of the artists who went against what they saw, rightly or wrongly, as the dominant grain of industrially oriented art, towards something that he saw as more psychologically complex, less rational. In wildly imaginative installations, as well as prolific notebooks, he seemed to depart from reality associated with fantasy and specific cultural, countercultural references. And this is Tech in his own studio, and he's the guy sitting up, and that's the model that he's making of himself. This is Tech in a studio shot working on The Tomb, which was originally called Death of a Hippie. In 1967, he built an 8-foot-high pink pyramid tomb in which lay a figure cast from the artist's own body, adorned with a blonde wig and a pink suit. The relics around him invoked ancient ceremonies like incense and goblets, but also contemporary hippie culture linking the two and marking the passing not only of the ancient culture, but also the contemporary hippie culture, the death of utopian hopes for the politics of the 1960s. Space exploration would seem to be the most resolutely futuristic, forward-looking aspect of the time. When JFK accepted the Democratic nomination for president in 1960, he did so in Los Angeles. And yet, he proclaimed in familiar language in that site of the former frontier, a new frontier, one of unknown opportunities and perils, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats. And so when Tech is looking up into the sky, and this is a small painting he made, looking up in wonder, it resonates with the ancient, connecting our wonder before space with the caveman. So the caveman looking up and looking at the stars and thinking that they're gods, not knowing about science. And it's evoked in this charming painting on paper. Tech's painting bears a remarkable resemblance to the Whole Earth catalog of spring 1969, in which one section features books on images of the Earth as seen from space, taken by NASA, images of the Earth's surface, and extreme close-ups of the human body. The famous image of the cover of the issue, the Earth seen from outer space, was a powerful imaginary object even before it existed. In 1966, Stuart Brand, the man who started the Whole Earth Catalog, had initiated a public campaign to have NASA release the then-rumored satellite image of the Earth as seen from space. People thought that NASA had it but wouldn't release it. He thought the image of our planet might be a powerful symbol evoking adaptive strategies from people and drove across America from Berkeley to New York selling buttons that read, "Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet?" So it's interesting that already the way that Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog and Tech are invoking outer space is, you know, looking to the future and to the past at the same time, just as JFK says this is a new frontier, but he also... The very use of the frontier implies that older American history. And the Cold War, to the race to the moon and the race to space brought two new First Man episodes, the First Man in Space and the First Man on the Moon. On July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong commanded the Apollo 11 moon landing mission, in which he and Buzz Aldrin walked on the lunar surface, the famous giant step for mankind. In human history, there are very few firsts. We've done so much of this that equal this obvious momentousness. So it's not surprising that this very futuristic milestone would so be so frequently imagined as a fetal one of births and beginnings. As television news anchor Eric Severide said in narrating Armstrong's moonwalk, "We've seen some kind of birth here." Science fiction and pop culture sometimes trace the beginning even further back, linked not only to babies, but also to earlier evolutionary beginnings, to cavemen and even pre-human ancestors, as in the popular Planet of the Apes series, or skipping evolution to other mythological beginnings. Amusingly, Armstrong's biographer, who refers to him as the first man in capital letters, writes, "Fittingly, for the family history of the first man, the ancestry goes back literally to Adam, Armstrong's ancestor who immigrated to America in the 18th century." And so they tie him to not only to Adam and to the Bible, but to the Mayflower. As NASA artist Paul Kahl said, "I like to use the analogy of oneness that I see between Neil Armstrong's boot sinking into the dust of the moon and the moccasined foot of a man like John Coulter sinking into the snow as he entered Yellowstone River Valley for the first time." Robert Rauschenberg was invited by NASA to witness the launch of Apollo 11 and to make a work of art in response. And he was living in Florida at the time. His series of lithographs, Stoned Moon, 1969 to 1970, was made quickly in the following month. For the series, Robert Rauschenberg juxtaposed NASA photographs of the rocket with creatures and scenery from Florida's natural world. So you have the rocket, but you also have the water bird there. The stoned part of the title is a pun on the lithograph, which is made from a stone, and its prehistoric connotations, as in the artist's famous complaint that here we are in the 20th century and artists are still drawing on rocks. But it also references the psychedelic nature of the experience, how incredibly bizarre it was to see a rocket launched into space. From early on, space travel had been an apparition from and of the future, a fantasy of what the future would bring. Later, it also became an exit strategy from a ruined Earth. With the 20th century, it also became inextricably tied to weaponry as the rocket program overseen by Wernher von Braun developed the V-2 missile in Germany, the first object ever to leave the Earth's atmosphere. And so Rauschenberg is characteristically humorous and more upbeat. But other artists made a sort of darker connection between space travel and the bomb. This is Vaya Selmans from the same year, and this is her drawing of Hiroshima, the devastated city after the bomb. This is her drawing of Bikini, the test blast of the atomic bomb. The same year, she also made a meticulous drawing, these are all hand-done in graphite, of the moon surface, the depopulated surfaces linked by association. And finally, the following year, beginning her series of deserts, drawn first in Death Valley in California, then New Mexico and Arizona, which connects that depopulated sort of barren surface from Hiroshima to the moon and then back to Earth in a sort of normal landscape. Here, the empty land for Selmans signifies both its virgin nature, as if it's never been populated, with the West being the frontier, and then its post-apocalyptic state. So the image of the astronaut is both man of the future and possibly the last man. As Robert Smithson said, space age and stone age attitudes overlap to form the zero zone where the spaceman meets the brontosaurus in a Jurassic swamp on Mars. So you have this sense of extreme past and future imploding. And by the end of the 60s, JFK's new frontier had become the final frontier, and is in the famous voiceover for the television series Star Trek. So looking up at the sky is not just romantic, but also a sense of, there's a desperate sense of the need to escape. Moving into the 70s, that sort of utopian balance, the utopian aspect of the 60s had largely disappeared. And so the primitivism that you have in New York City is really graffiti as its primary expression. And so it rises in the early 70s in New York, and it's both decried as a plague on the subway cars of New York City. Oh, this is ruining New York, and it's a very destructive impulse, but it's also seen as something that's extremely creative. It's also absolutely seen in relation to the wall painting or the cave painting of Altamira and Lescaut. And so the discussion is back and forth. Is New York dying and falling apart, or is this a new resurgence of creativity? And out of that emerges Keith Haring, who brings the sort of science technological part back to it. And so was there primitivism in the 80s and 90s? There, Keith Haring is working out of graffiti culture, making his early drawings in white chalk on blackout paper, used to blackout advertisements in public areas, mostly the subway. And so he pairs, this is one of those drawings, he pairs his best-known image, the radiant baby, that baby crawling cartoon figure, with classic flying saucer ships, robots, and nuclear reactors. There's a nuclear reactor on the left, and he was originally from Kurtztown near Three Mile Island, the reactor where the 1979 meltdown occurred. But he also has the pyramid that we've seen with from Tech and from Alan Shields, and then he has a very early image of a computer. And one curator refers to this mode of art making as techno-primitivism. And this is really quite common in the early 1980s. It's humorous, but it's also apocalyptic. The very important 1983 show, Science Fiction, in New York City, the whole gallery was painted with black walls and then filled with flashing lights. And this is a sculpture called Disco Mummy by Taro Suzuki, which again has that feeling of the discotheque and this thing that's futuristic and the strobing lights with a sort of ancient form. And the gallery and the catalog were also filled with film stills from movies like Road Warrior. And he says in the catalog that current science fiction portrays not a technocratic utopian future, but a future in which nuclear apocalypse is almost a given. But you can see then this is the future, but it's a future which is primitivistic, and even down to the image of Native American kind of dress and hairdo. And we should remember that punk, the Mohawk is an indigenous Indian hairdo originally. More positively, there was much more attention given to artists who had actual claim to a Native American heritage or other indigenous identity, artists like Edgar Heap of Birds and Kay Walking Stick. And a landmark 1987 performance by James Luna at the Museum of Man in San Diego, the artist lay in a vitrine-like case surrounded by didactic labels, so he is like the museum, a living museum exhibit. He was wearing a loincloth and lay with his eyes closed, playing dead. Many of the works of the time referred to the self as primitive, a fetishized object, to the history of display of human beings, as well as utilitarian and ceremonial objects in museums as part of anthropological and also aesthetic exhibitions. So he's surrounded, you know, like an Indian, a figure in the Museum of Natural History in New York. But the objects that he's surrounded with are not, you know, like Indian peace pipes or headdresses, but his 8-track tapes, his Motown tape collection, his divorce decree, and the didactic label refers to his death from excessive drinking. So the viewers who happened on Luna's exhibition, they expected some museum presentation of Native American cultures as in the past, which museums always do, museums of natural history. This is the ancient past. Instead see a real, not a live Indian, but a real portrayal of contemporary Native culture, not a romantic vision of the past. Combining the violence of the cowboy settler with the idealism and severity of Shakers or Thoreau is another variation on primitivism, not looking back to Native American, but to early settlers and early Americana and connecting it to contemporary culture. In 1975, when he was just 20 years old, Fred Tomaselli hitchhiked from California to Vermont, where he found an older group of Marxists in retreat from the American 50s, as well as a culture of younger hippie dropouts. Quickly, however, he decided that the scene was too mellow for him, and he spent a year hitchhiking back to Southern California. But he kept a memory of that culture of communes and people escaping from high culture and from organized society. And he picks this up in his paintings, paintings with titles like Goth and Desert Bloom. And here is Desert Bloom from 2000, which is a very large-scale painting, which tracks this idea of the American wish to retreat, to live off the grid, to be independent, to be self-reliant, in Emerson's words, all of these impulses throughout American culture. So he creates this web of buildings that make these references. And there, by the way, you can see in the upper left at the top what a Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome looks like. So he has geodesic domes. He has David Koresh's compound at Waco. He has a Quaker meeting house. He has Charles Manson's headquarters in Barker Ranch near Death Valley and in Spawn Ranch near Cal Arts. He has Ted Kaczynski's The Unabomber's Cabin. And so all of these, from Ted Kaczynski to Charles Manson, reveal the dark side of Emersonian self-reliance, of the American dream of individualism and self-creation on the blank slate of the frontier. Alongside these ideals, or perhaps beneath them, there's also this very antisocial, and that's Waco in the upper left, antisocial millennialism, the regeneration through violence required to wipe the slate clean, to create a new world perfect in nature, uncorrupted by civilization or computers, and Kaczynski's particular interest. And he connects the computer to the atomic bomb, which is actually accurate, because the network of scientists that were used to build the atomic bomb were then kept in place and gave rise to what we know today as the internet. So that the atomic bomb was the first sort of mass scientific organized project, collective science project, and that same, in the U.S. Army, that same agency is the one that developed the original internet. So Kaczynski lived in a cabin in the woods. He was not a pioneer exploring and pressing on the boundaries of the present terrain, but rather in retreat from the future or the frontier. And throughout the 1990s, this dark tone has only gotten more pronounced and is particularly centered around urban apocalypses, with Detroit as the epicenter. And there's something now people call ruin porn, which is a genre of photographs of Detroit and the crumbling of the foreclosed houses and of the urban sites. But a few years ago, Mike Kelly combined space travel with a vision of crumbling Detroit, a kind of ultimate ruin, which has really replaced New Jersey as the site of America as an already dead or already over society, seen from an apocalyptic future. And Detroit is obviously the home of the once triumphant automobile industry, as well as the home of Mike Kelly himself. And it's been tied to obsolescence and garbage. You know, cars represented the great promise of America after World War II, American industry of luxury, of trading in your car every year, of planned obsolescence. And now it's tied to garbage and to the waste from those industries. Kelly toured the islands of the Detroit River, and he finds a garbage dump in one of those islands. And out of the garbage, he builds this monumental statue of John Glenn, the astronaut, after whom his own high school in Detroit was named. And he connects, and there you see the waste, which he's kind of sorted into. It's actually quite beautiful, the plastic and glass from the garbage dump on the floor there, sorted by color. And he connects this astronaut here, who he photographs. This is the original statue, with a statue of Bigfoot, which is carved with a chainsaw. And he's also interested in folk sculpture as an important American, part of American history. So it's a sculpture of Bigfoot, or there's some sort of ancient primordial caveman connected to the presence of the astronaut, like Robert Smithson, putting them together. The other country that this sort of emphasis on ruins has centered, the other city that this emphasis on ruins has centered on is New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and which has been compared most notably by Spike Lee to the effect of the bomb on Hiroshima. You know, Spike Lee said afterwards, I can't believe this could happen in America. It looks like Hiroshima. And even though it was a natural disaster, a lot of people complained that it was actually inflicted by humans because of the way they disregarded the levee and maintaining it. And in 2008, artist Mark Bradford, whose work can be seen right now in Dallas, if you don't mind making the trip to Dallas, it's really worth seeing. And he traveled to New Orleans, where here in the Lower Ninth Ward, the poorest and most hard-hit part of the city, he built this large-scale ark out of sort of used signage and posters that he had found in his own neighborhood, which is Limert Park in South Central Los Angeles, a part of Los Angeles with its own history of disaster. And his arc obviously anchors the biblical narrative of new beginnings predicated on disaster. And the title, Mithra, refers to a still more ancient pre-biblical mythology of rebirth. The same year, in 2008, Bradford's project for the Carnegie International Art Exhibit recalls that photograph from Katrina, where of people building on their roofs the signs that said "Help Us," which were meant to be read by helicopters. And he does this in white stone on the roof of the building. Visible only from the air. It's an artwork not in the museum, but on the roof of the museum, meant to be seen from the air. It's not clear to whom the words were addressed. It was broadcast all over the world, just like the photographs from Katrina were. The best known of the photographs from Katrina was of a woman kneeling in the street, hands clasped and raised up, with a caption explaining that she was crying, "Help us, please." Others included people on rooftops who had painted or used tape to write messages that read, "The water is rising, please help," or "We're Americans, please help." What Bradford sees, he spells us, "Help us," in stone, implying a problem that is once archaic and that's ancient, by using the stone and enduring into the future to be found by archaeologists. That sort of aerial view that implies a devastated, lost civilization, like the aerial views of Hiroshima, to be seen by rescuers, by archaeologists, by aliens. We're not quite sure. The very American artist, Mark Bradford, sees the devastation of disaster, but also the possibilities. "I have always liked potentiality better than actuality. We all wait for the storm." So for him, the storm and the devastation has redemptive possibilities as well as disastrous. And the storm that Bradford seeks seems to be here, not only literally in extreme climate change, but also finally, maybe really, in the end of America that so many people see in the current economic and political situation. Or maybe just in a particular version of America, the short American century, which began gradually to take hold in the economic ascension of the country in the 20s, then came definitively with the end of World War II. At the same time, many claimed that moment of domination was the end of America as historically constituted, as it marked the full entanglement of the nation into global art, into global affairs. One end after another has followed: recessions, military defeats in Vietnam and the Middle East, the attack on American ground of September 11th, 2001, the enormous economic crash of 2008. So we're not sure here, and Bradford seems to be asking us, is this the end of the American century? Is this the end of America? Or is it just another apocalyptic chapter in a very long history of them? Thank you. Are there any questions, Terry?
This sort of references some of what you talked about tonight, but it may reference something earlier in the book, too. In reading, I'm to chapter 4, so I don't know what chapter it's in, 2 or 3, but there's some talk about how artists had, through their frustrations, were checking out of the art world, you know, mm-hmm. I just couldn't help but think about it, being that having just seen the Murcio Catalan exhibition of Guggenheim. Could you talk a little bit about this place, perhaps, you know, his very, very contemporary position, you know, that exhibition being perhaps the last thing he does in the art world, and just the display or the hanging as it was hanging.
And this may or may not fit into the book, but this was a big new show that just opened in New York. It's Maurizio Catalan, who's an Italian artist, but is one of the first generation of really truly global artists, you know, artists in the 1990s, who really got their attention by showing together all over Europe. And the U.S. and Rick Ritchie of Indonesia might be the best known of them, who became well known for serving pad thai to people as his art, as his art exhibition. So Catalan has decided, he's 51 or 52 years old, and he was offered a retrospective. And traditionally, a lot of American artists have had trouble with retrospectives. Like, de Kooning never wanted a retrospective. So it's funny to see them now, because they had the feeling they didn't want to be shown as their lives being over. A retrospective is a summing up, and it's like, that's it, it's over, you're in the history book. So this is what made Barnett Newman very angry in 1965 when LA County did a show of abstract expressionism. He said, oh, that's it, we're all, it's all like we're dead. So they wanted to be relevant and contemporary rather than to be seen as masters. So it is different from, say, Picasso or Matisse and their attitude towards exhibitions. But so Maurizio Catalan decided, well, the summing up came at a time when he didn't have anything else to do or say. His art is based on sort of one-liners and jokes. Like, there's a very, very wealthy collector named Peter Brandt. He's probably one of the 10 wealthiest art collectors in the world. And he's married to the supermodel, former model Stephanie Seymour, who's very beautiful. And so he wanted a portrait of his wife, and he commissioned Maurizio Catalan. And what he did was to make a trophy head of his wife, so that he could put in his study with all of his hunting heads, chest out. So this is what he does. But it, you know, so when your art is sort of one-liners, it can be hard to get. To keep doing that year after year. And this is also part of, I have to say, this is, and he's not American, but I think this is, I mean, part of what I want to argue is that the way that American history redefined contemporary art has become now the model for the entire world, because we're the last, this is the last place where that was dominant. And so the model for an American artist is very often not progressive. It's a trajectory not of growth and maturity, but of breakthrough and change and trying to change. Frank Stella, Jackson Pollock, these are people who didn't want to just develop and their hand scale and make the same thing over and over again, which means it's very hard to continue that as you get older. Everyone wants you to stay the same so they can buy it, but if you stay the same, then they say you're old news. You know, it's an impossible place for an artist. And so some artists in the 60s, their answer, every generation has a different answer. In the 50s, artists like Jackson Pollock tried to change and then drank too much when it didn't work. In the 60s and 70s, a lot of artists, when I'm talking about back to the land, while people were going back to the land to go farming, a lot of artists were dropping out of the art world, either to make art in private or to make crafts instead, like beads. A lot of them, Alan Shields wasn't making a living, and so he became a tugboat captain, and he was also a train conductor. But he made beads and necklaces for all the other train conductors. So you saw them on the railroad during the shift, they'd all be wearing necklaces. But so they dropped out of the art world and out of the rat race. So someone like Maurizio Catalan hasn't. What would you say, what's the ethos of the 2000s, or how do we think about those problems of career? Most artists think they would be lucky to have any kind of show anywhere, so it seems like a strange problem to have. But his idea is, I'm just going to stop. And it's not that he's dropping out against the rat race, but instead of trying to find a new thing to say, he feels like it doesn't come from inside, and his art comes from reacting to situations. So his next thing might even not be being an artist. It might be to be, you know, he has a magazine, he might make films. Mm-hmm. So it's a different sense of being an artist.
Like, yeah. Do you think that there is such a thing as an American artist when there are global artists? I mean, do you think there's still... Can you think of artists working now that are...
Oh, no, Mike Kelly, he's like Tom Selleck, but those are works made just from the last few years. Matthew Day Jackson, who I showed just briefly at the beginning with Hiroshima and the Nagasaki, those wooden paintings, he's probably... most like suddenly picked up young artists with huge shows and all over Europe.
What would make him American artist? Is it the fact that he is in fact American, or is there something about the work that makes?
I mean, there are artists just like there are artists in Europe who continue to consciously draw on their native tradition. Mm-hmm. There are artists in America who do that consciously. I mean, there are all different ways to be. American. I mean, and part of the reason I came to this book was that I had done some work for Takashi Murakami, the Japanese artist, and then I had a lot of graduate students who were Japanese and Korean, and I was looking at a lot of contemporary Japanese and Korean art and realizing that they saw so often contemporary world through their own historical background because their ideas about the world and their aesthetic didn't match up necessarily with what was global and international. So I began to see how many American artists were doing this. Mm-hmm. So more generally, I began to see that the way that we look at art was kind of wrong, the academic way of looking at art, but also that this was a rich and interesting tradition for young artists. So these are issues that artists always face, like in South America. You know, artists face this in the 50s and 60s. Do you make international art, and so that you can be shown in Paris and be included in discussions of abstract art? So Elio Oiticica, who's probably the best known Brazilian artist, starts out making neo-concrete, you know, monochromes. But then, or do you make art that has something to do with your own background? And then he starts making the, you know, pieces where he's learning to samba and using really bright colors and making capes for people to wear when they're dancing. And, you know, there's that struggle. You want to be able to do what you want to do, but you also, including being an international artist and making things that are seen as not about your identity, but I think a lot of artists also want to be able to include where they come from. And I think that's that's also a problem for African American artists, for, you know, for lots of different people. But I think it's also interesting. Can be an interesting and particularly American problem because so much of where we all come from is a background where we didn't grow up seeing art. You know, and so what you have instead, this has shaped a lot of American art from the 20th century. What you have instead of looking towards high art is looking towards mass culture, in particular a sort of middle class taste. That's not like bohemian, looking at sort of taboo, very low, risque culture, but like really middle class taste, which is the last great taboo, I think, in art. So it might be, you know, it might be Jeff Koons looking at his, like the porcelain tchotchkes that were in his grandparents' house, or Matthew Day Jackson looking at muscle cars. But I think that's the thing that a lot of Americans are interested in. It's just material culture that is particularly American. So that makes that identity more widespread than saying French artists aren't making art about France. All high culture is just French, if that makes sense.
This really picks up on what you're just saying. I wonder if you could spend a little bit. American exceptionalism has really been seen negatively as a myth for a long time, but it sounds like you're trying to bring it back in.
I mean, the problem with it, and I've read a lot of those books about, you know, arguing that there's a school of history writing that says, oh, American exceptionalism means that we write about America differently. But it makes it sound that we write, what they really mean is different from Europe. They don't mean different from China, or different from Japan, or different from Chile. They mean different from Europe. So I came, again, spending a lot of time working with, so I mean, starting out, I thought, well, it doesn't have to be better just because it's different. It doesn't mean that I'm arguing America is so great and better than, I mean, there are a lot of great things about America, but I'm not saying it's better than other places, just that it has a different history than Europe. And then, again, working with Murakami and with more international artists, I realized Japanese culture is so, and its relationship to art is so much more like America's than it is like Europe. They did not have a term for fine art or high art until very recently. And it wasn't until the opening of Japan in the 19th century, the forcible opening, that they began to hierarchize things. And so what's really exceptional is Europe. That's the place that's weird, you know, it's anomalous. So, like, if I were a historian as opposed to an art historian, I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I prefer to work with artists and art objects, but I would write a book about European exceptionalism and how that's a different history. And all of those very particular conditions that give rise to something called high art, you know, and that's a weird set of conditions that other people have written about, but it's so different from the historical trajectory of other countries.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up, do you think there's a New York exceptionalism that views the art world very differently than...
Well, I mean, we think we're the center of the world, the exception of New York, and, you know, people are now making a real case for Los Angeles, yeah, you know, as having its own... center of gravity. I think you could certainly, having lived in Texas for a number of years, you could certainly make an argument for, you know, there being scenes in Texas, you know, in Houston at different times, you know, different places at different times, and Chicago. But what I think is interesting is that when people hear American, and in the 30s, what people meant when they said American, what the Whitney Museum meant, what artists meant, was white Protestant settlers. What New York reminds us of is that American means immigrants, you know, and that it means Jews, it means Central Americans, it means people who came here against their will, it means, you know, all kinds of complicated things, and that is part of, you know, if not the most part, important part of American identity, is that everyone is so different. And so the whole idea of pluralism, which I write about in another chapter, the whole idea of everyone being different and doing different things, as opposed to having one central modernist tradition, pluralism is a word that's first used in the early 20th century to talk about America and its population of people. So it's not surprising that the idea of a pluralistic art really takes root here, finally, in the 1970s and 80s, takes place here in America. And part of that is New York, but New York is not so different from America in certain ways. Other people?
I was wondering how, like, I'm trying to figure out how you might account for some of the sort of socioeconomic things that you're talking about in terms of American national history as being connected to sort of globalized histories, like, you know, things such as post-Fordism, neoliberalism, globalization. I mean, Detroit didn't just fall in on itself on its own, right? These were connected to global trends. The same thing with New York in the 70s. And, I mean, even someone like Lucy Lepard, who had that political conversion by seeing Tuclanarde in Buenos Aires. So, like, there's... I feel like there are other trends that exist that are sort of crossing national borders within intercultural.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, like I say in the beginning, we are all part of the same, mm-hmm. and now increasingly. Now, I mean, this is why we're hearing so much about Chinese art, because every time somebody else enters the social system that we are already part of, then suddenly they're in the art world. So we are all in the, now everybody's in modern capitalist society. And so there are a lot of things that are in common. I think when people say post-Fordism, and it can be a real trap. It's so general. I mean, he means the transition from production-based to a service economy, or an information-based economy, as people call it. And I would say there are some very interesting research about that coming out of the bottom too. You know, it's part of the internet, but. You know, the people who brought you the atomic bomb and the Whole Earth Catalog are now bringing you Google. But that that it's all part of the same, it's also part of the same culture, but post-Fordism can be such a generalization. So the idea that we all live in a post-Fordist world and that explains everything, when in fact, the thing is, people are still made the shoes you're wearing, you know, and they're just making them somewhere
just
else.
Just not here. Right.
Just not here. So that really has very local effects as opposed to sort of broad theoretical effects. So post-Fordism is not happening in China, you know. So, but if you were going to talk about the United States, that definitely had a huge effect. On Detroit. And you can see it affects art. It's made differently in different places. Like art in Mexico City, the scene is so different because there's so many people making things. There's so many artisans, and so that you can think that the artists go to different parts of the city and have a dialogue with people who might make things for them or with them. And it makes a very different kind of art. And brings a catalog with all the work just sort of shopped out, like wherever, and it all looks exactly the same. So the joke is the figure and the context, but not the factor, not how it's made. So that's something that's been so important for American art, how it was made. I'd say that problem of post-Fordism or service economy is particular here. And then as far as other trajectories and stuff, yes, absolutely. This doesn't attempt to be a definitive history or one that accounts for all of those different factors. It's more of a one story and a corrective, I think, to the dominant way that it's been told, because those other histories are not, like, art since 1900, or, you know, they're not talking about Buenos Aires either. So.
Along with pluralism, do you deal with women as an entity?
No. I mean, I think the way, and I've had other projects that focused on the role of women, whatever, not really here, because I think that the chapter where I focus on gender is called Success and Failure. You know, and this really falls primarily on men. And I guess I was interested, because success is such an American idea. It really is not an American idea. And it's really not an idea for European artists, even though they'd like to be successful or whatever. So, and there's also not the idea of failure as an individual responsibility. Like, you know, you lost your house, or are you an idiot? You know, whereas Europe, the thinking is done more socially rather than individuals bearing responsibility, whether you're rich or poor, you know, that fantasy. And so that chapter ended up being a lot about gender, but it was really about and I feel like that history has been really underwritten, you know, in terms of art and what it means, how male gender plays into American art making. From, you know, it's usually called macho and then dismissed, but I got really interested in it. So no, not so much women, except to say they were left out of this primarily.
You did talk about feminism being the impetus for the, in some ways, for the male movement too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't leave women out. You know, just, there are women in, you know, who are part of
it. You just don't deal with it particularly.
No, I wasn't able to locate something. I mean, there are plenty of particularly American stereotypes, I mean, types, archetypes for, you know, women, but it didn't seem to be a dialectic that was particularly figuring anything about American history or American art.
Women are people too.
They are real. Anybody else? Thanks so much.
Thank you.